prepare for a true revolution.
Actually, you can prove God exists.
Questioning tradition, because what you've been taught isn't always true.
The truth will set you free.
The truth will set you free. Good morning, Truth Revolution. I'm Dave, and with me, as always, is Pastor Jeff of Revolution Church.
Good morning. I'm glad you guys could be here today.
Yeah, we got a great show.
We do. We have a special guest, Dr. Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe, and we're going to get to him in just a minute. But first, I want to tell you about our show today, let you know what's coming up. Of course, we are going to be doing a Bible contradiction. As usual.
It's our thing, like you said a couple minutes ago.
Now, did you get this Bible contradiction from evilbible.com
no,
like we always
I
do?
No, I didn't. I got this. The one that we got today is coming from thethinkingatheist.com.
Okay.
Trying to change it up.
Hey, we did that last week.
Yeah.
They were more thoughtful.
They were.
Thus, the thinking atheist.
Right.
Okay, so maybe this one will be better than some of them, more difficult, more challenging.
Right.
We'll see. We'll do that. We're going to be talking about the ENCODE project.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Dr. Rana, who is our guest today, knows all about, and I know very little about.
Me too.
But you say you know very little about everything.
You know what? You're the smart one out of the two of
us.
You have a college degree. I just kind of hang out on the street and, you know, be funny. Sort of.
Wow. Is this a bad time to tell you you're not really that funny?
No.
Oh, okay, I'm just
kidding. Because I don't believe you.
Okay, good. And if we have time to, we're gonna get to some discussion on Peter, James, and Paul and about how they followed Jesus and the significance of them turning to Jesus after being persecuted and before being persecuted again, and how this plays in with Easter, since last week was Easter.
Right on.
So, anyway, today I want to welcome to our show Dr. Fuzz Rana from Reasons to Believe. Their website is reasons.org, and he is a full-on PhD. Dr. Rana is an accomplished biochemist. He is the executive vice president of research and apologetics at Reasons to Believe. And he has authored and co-authored books, The Origins of Life, Who Was Adam, and most recently, The Cell's Design.
So he's a really smart guy.
He is super smart. He's going to put us to shame, Dave. Dr. Rana, welcome. I'm glad you could be with us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely.
We're kind of excited about this, actually.
Yeah, I was telling Dave, I'm a little nervous. This is going to be great. And you've actually published numerous articles in peer-reviewed scientific journals. Is that correct?
I sure have, yes.
So
I've worked as a scientist for many years before kind of leaving that behind and working in full-time in ministry through Reasons to Believe.
That's great. And I want this to be absolutely clear to the listeners, because we have listeners who are Christians and listeners who are not. We're not just coming in and getting a preacher such as myself to give us a message. You are a scientist who've chosen to go into ministry. Is that right?
That's exactly right, because I've always been fascinated, being a Christian and being a scientist, as to how science and faith fit together. And, it's been about 17 years ago now, I really felt that this was something that I should devote my life to, is to showing people how the latest discoveries in science provide evidence for the Christian faith. So many people think of science and faith as being at odds with each other, and that really is not the case whatsoever. And so I felt like this is really an important thing to devote my life to, or the remainder of my life to, is, again, showing people that there's harmony between science and faith, and that science is not a reason to reject Christianity.
Yeah, that's really awesome, because really that's why we started our radio show, was to show that there was a connection between science and faith. You don't have to give up one to enjoy the other.
Absolutely. As our tagline says, where faith and reason meet. That's what we want this show to be about. And it certainly sounds like your whole life is kind of where faith and reason meet. So
that's exactly right. And it doesn't mean that we still don't have to exercise faith as Christians, but it means that our faith has a rational basis to it, that it's reasonable, that it's not just simply blind, wishful thinking, but there's really an evidentiary basis for the ideas that we hold dear as Christians.
Yeah, I was in McDonald's actually just a couple days ago, and there were some guys sitting in the booth behind me, and one of the guys said, they were talking about church, and he said, I just don't know if I believe all that anymore. And I couldn't help myself. I turned around and started engaged in a conversation with him. One of the other guys said, well, it's just faith. You just got to have faith. And I said, well, you do, but you don't have to have blind faith.
Right.
So, absolutely. Well, hey, Dr. Rana, we are so glad to have you here today. We want to talk about the ENCODE project. Now, this ENCODE project is a project about DNA research. Could you tell us a little bit about what this is?
Sure thing. Well, the ENCODE project is kind of a follow-up to the Human Genome Project, and this was a 15-year endeavor that began in 1985 and was kind of brought to fruition in 2000, and when the entire human genome was sequenced. And so the human genome essentially consists of the DNA molecules that contain information needed to build human beings. It contains the blueprint of life. And the way the molecule is structured is it's formed from these sequences of smaller molecules, and those sequences are like letters that are used to make up words. They contain instructions. They contain information, again, that's needed to build the organism. And so the goal of the Human Genome Project was to determine the entire sequence of, again, the human genome, which was about 3.2 billion genetic letters. Now, the problem was that once we had that sequence, nobody really knew how to read it. And no. So the ENCODE project is essentially a project designed to identify all the different functional elements in the human genome. It's kind of like the Rosetta Stone for the human genome, so we now know what parts of the human genome are functional, what parts are not, and what the different parts of the human genome are doing. And this is very, very helpful in terms of understanding human biology and comparing how human beings are similar and different to other organisms. It's going to have important biomedical applications. But from an apologetic standpoint, it's a huge discovery.
So the Human Genome Project was kind of like discovering 3 billion different hieroglyphics, and the ENCODE project is trying to decipher those hieroglyphics. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, and the ENCODE project is no small enterprise. I mean, this is a project that has involved over 400 scientists from 30 labs around the world. They've probably spent, close to $235 million on this project in order to get to the what's called phase two of the project, and phase three is now underway. But this is, again, a real exciting project that is now, for the first time, making it possible to look at the human genome and understand what exactly the information in the genome means from a biochemical standpoint.
And this was started in 2003, the ENCODE project was, as far as I understand. And
yes.
So, and it's about 10 years now, and they're going into phase three. What were these different phases? How does that work?
Well, phase one, again, took about 4 years, and it was just simply a pilot phase. Can we make this, can we get this experiment or these sets of experiments to work in a way that we know that it's going to tell us information about the functional elements in the human genome? So they only looked at 1% of the human genome. And then with the pilot phase being successful, they went into phase two, and that phase has had its results published just last September, in September of 2012. And then phase three will probably be essentially an ongoing phase. But the phase two results took a look at the entire human genome and, again, identified all the functional elements that make up the human genome.
Yeah, I like how you said the phase one only dealt with 1%.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's only like 30 million of pieces of our
that's right.
DNA. So,
well,
you know.
And that project cost, you know, $55 million to undertake. And so, because it was successful, they spent another $150 million or so on the project.
Okay, now, here's the deal for our listeners that are probably going, okay, so why do I care about this?
Right.
One of the biggest problems for Christians, or at least it was, I don't know if it was a problem for Christians, but it was a point of contention that people would use against Christianity, was that people used to say that our DNA, and they still say that our DNA contains a lot of unnecessary junk, leftovers from evolution. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. Because when the human genome was sequenced and there was some initial analysis done of it, it turns out that only 2% of the human genome contains the information needed to make proteins, and everybody just assumed the remaining 98% was probably junk DNA, garbage pieces of DNA that represent the vestiges of an evolutionary process. And moreover, that junk DNA was shared between humans and chimpanzees. And so they argued the only way to make sense of this is that our genome, and in fact, human beings are the product of evolution, and we share an evolutionary history with chimpanzees. But along comes the phase two results of the ENCODE project, and they determined that 80% of the human genome consists of functional DNA elements. And so instead of seeing the human genome as this vast wasteland of junk, it turns out that it's an incredibly elegantly designed system where all that DNA is actually playing a very important role in how the human genome operates.
And so it's not actually the case that 98% of our DNA is junk.
That's exactly right. Again, you could easily argue that the human genome reflects the work of a mind, reflects the work of a creator, and that those shared sequences between humans and chimpanzees, because they are functional, reflect common design, not common descent from an evolutionary ancestor.
Yeah, and common design makes sense, as we've often pointed out. If you have a common design, I mean, that can easily show that you have a common designer, not just descent. I mean, there's no reason to think one way or the other.
Right. It's like a toy maker putting a stamp on a toy. I mean, I hate to break it down that simple.
Right. Now,
that's exactly right. And that argument is very easy to make when things are functional. But when things are shared but they're not functional, then the question is, why would a creator produce identical genomes that have the same non-functional pieces in the same spots? And so that became a really serious challenge to the whole idea of intelligent design and biblical creationism. And so the ENCODE project essentially allows us to now respond to that challenge head on in a way that's, I think, scientifically robust.
Right. And now I want to think about this for a minute, because we've said it's no longer the case that there's 99% junk DNA. We probably had a creator, because most of our DNA is actually usable. I did some reading on this. You talked about it. 80% of our DNA is usable, according to this ENCODE project. So, you know, what about that other 20%? We're coming up to a break here, but we're going to get to that other 20% here on the other side of this break. Mm-hmm. We're going to also talk to some things called the C-value enigma, how little tiny organisms have more DNA than we do.
Right, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah, so we're going to be right back with Dr. Rana. But hey, we want to invite you out to Revolution Church.
Yes, coming up at 10:15.
This morning. And you can come however you are. You can come in a jeans and a t-shirt.
Right.
You can come in pajamas.
Right, and we've seen it.
Just come with something.
Right, and we invite everybody. So come on out and enjoy God.
And also get out to our website, truthrevolution.tv. You can donate. You can listen to old shows. And we're going to put up a link to Dr. Rana's site, reasons.org. Hi, this is Pastor Jeff from Revolution Church. Not only am I the host of the Truth Revolution radio program, but I'm also a foster parent. Did you know that there are only 20 or 30 children in Salina that need to be adopted right now? Did you know that there are children in foster care who want to live in Salina, but are sometimes placed in other towns because we don't have enough foster homes here? I want to challenge you to consider foster care today. If you're interested in doing foster care, go to kfapa.com. That's K-F-A-P-A, as in the Kansas Foster and Adoptive Parent Association.com. K-F-A-P-A.com, and get more information. You can request information, email and ask any questions you want, or possibly even sign up to take a class about foster parenting. It's easier and more difficult than you'd ever imagine, but it's also more rewarding than you'd ever imagine. Consider fostering and helping a child in need today.
You're invited to Revolution Church this Sunday. Don't wear a suit and tie. Nobody else does. Just come as you are. Revolution Church has a special kids program planned, rocking music, and teaching that actually matters for real life. 10:15 this Sunday morning. Just music, teaching, and a program for the kids. 10:15 this Sunday morning. Check us out online, salinarevolution.com. www.salinarevolution.com.
Truth Revolution.
And we are back.
Thanks for joining us again today.
Oh, yeah. We're talking today to Fuzz Rana
from reasons.org.
He's a scientist.
He is an intelligent scientist, which is better than just a plain scientist.
Right.
He is here from Reasons to Believe, and he is talking to us about the ENCODE project and how it used to be said that our DNA was 98% junk.
Right, pretty much unusable. I mean,
and if that was the case, why would God design us that way? And really, that's a good question. You know, why would God design us with 98% junk DNA, especially that DNA corresponds to the type of DNA that other primates have?
Mm-hmm.
It really looked like evolution was true,
right,
and a designer was not playing the part.
Right, it looked like we were in the fourth quarter getting down to the end of it, and evolution was winning. But
then the ENCODE project
came in.
Now, Dr. Rana, you're here with us. Just so people know, the ENCODE project, this wasn't a Christian project, was it?
Oh, no. It was basically an international project funded by NIH and other organizations around the world, like the National Institutes of Health. But again, the focus of the program funded by me and you.
Right?
That's exactly.
Okay,
American taxpayers paid for
right
quite a bit of this.
Just wanted to clarify.
It's actually money well spent.
Yeah.
You know, because it's going to really, I think, transform how medicine is practiced in years to come, and is really going to help us understand, you know, the genetic basis of many diseases and disorders, and that's going to hopefully lead to better treatments and maybe even cures in some instances. So it's money well spent.
Now that's awesome.
The government's got to spend $300 million of our money. This is a good way to spend it.
Right.
Good idea. Now, we're going to get to some of those. I hope we get to some of those diseases and how this might help those things. But first, I got to ask. Okay, we said if there's 98% junk DNA and we share that with other primates, it kind of leads into maybe evolution's true and there was no designer. Well, the ENCODE project has said there's 80% usable DNA. But what about that other 20%? Doesn't that rule still apply?
Well, the fact of the matter is that remaining 20% probably will turn out to be functional as well.
Ah.
And this is, in fact, even a prediction made by Ewan Burney, who is the head of the ENCODE project. He's a scientist who's giving oversight to the entire project. And the ENCODE project began to look at different cell types in the human body and looked at the activity of the genome in those different cell types. There's 210 cell types. They only looked at 147.
Hmm.
And they only looked at those cell types at particular points in the cell cycle and at particular stages during the course of development. And so when you begin to fill in the table, so to speak, which is what's going to happen in phase three, more than likely that 20% is going to turn into basically 0%. And so I would argue that probably in time to come, we're going to realize that In fact, the entire human genome consists of functional DNA.
Now, that's interesting. Okay, I heard in one of your other interviews, because I was stalking you, that that some of these pieces of DNA kind of switch on when someone has a particular disease or a problem in their body. Is that potentially, I'm trying to understand, is that what some of this 20% might be, things that turn on at certain points?
Yeah, in a way, the way to look at it is 2% of the human genome contains the instructions needed to make the building materials for human beings, and the remaining 98% essentially contains information in terms of how to use those building blocks in each of the different cells in the human body at different points during the course of that cell cycle and during the course of development. And so in a sense, that 98% that doesn't code for, again, the information needed to make life's building blocks is containing the instructions. And so biochemists refer to that activity as gene regulation. So most of the human genome is devoted to gene regulation, which means that there are all these different layers of instructions that are going on within the human genome. And then some of that DNA also may be playing what would be called a skeletal role, helping to give the human genome a particular three-dimensional shape that's necessary for, again, the functioning of the genome. And so we're really beginning to develop a much more sophisticated view of how, you know, the human genome is put together, and it really looks like an incredibly sophisticated, incredibly elegantly designed system to me, not a hodgepodge production of evolution.
That's interesting. So these pieces that aren't being used right now, it's kind of like in our DNA, we assumed that this was all junk. But it's kind of like if you're flying in an airplane up in the sky and you've only seen it up in the sky and you look and you realize it has wheels tucked up underneath, you might assume, well, this is some junk from evolutionary times way back when it was a roller, but now it's a flyer. You know, until you see the plane land, you don't understand why it has wheels. Right. It might be
that's exactly right. And the same thing may be going on in the human genome with that 20% that we still haven't identified function for. It may be that at the particular point in the experiment where they were measuring the activity in the human genome, they didn't see function for it, but it's only because, you know, that cell wasn't needing that particular part of the genome at that particular point in time. But at another point in the cell cycle or during the course of development, that DNA very well may be needed.
That's interesting. Okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to come back on this, and we're going to talk about why some small creatures have DNA that's bigger and larger than ours. But for right now, we're going to jump in and do a Bible contradiction.
Bible contradiction.
All right, today's Bible contradiction comes from thethinkingatheist.com.
Yes.
And basically what they're asking, did Jesus speak at his hearing before Pilate or not? Matthew 27:11 versus John 18:37. Okay, so here we go. Matthew 27:11 says, "Meanwhile, Jesus stood before the governor, and then the governor asked him, 'Are you the king of the Jews?' 'Yes, it is as you say,' Jesus replied. When he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate asked him, 'Don't you hear the testimony they are bringing against you?' But Jesus made no reply, not even to a single charge, to the great amazement of the governor."
Okay, so he made no reply.
Right, now at John 18:37. The Pilate says, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You are right in saying that I am a king. In fact, for this reason I was born, and for this I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of truth listens to me."
So the question is,
did he speak at the hearing or not?
Well, he did speak at the hearing. Both John and Matthew say he spoke at the hearing.
Right.
Now, in our cracked acronym, we go to the very first letter C is for context. And you have to look at the context of what it means when it said that Jesus gave no reply, when he didn't speak. When it says that in the book of Matthew in verse 27, is it saying that he didn't speak at all? I don't think that Matthew's trying to say he didn't speak at all, because he just quoted Jesus speaking. It's not saying he didn't speak at all. It's saying that he did not speak to the chief priest and to the elders, because it says when he was accused by the chief priest and the elders, he gave no answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is not saying that Jesus didn't speak at all. It's only saying that these particular people he didn't speak to, he didn't answer their particular accusations. So, this is an important piece. When we talk about Bible contradictions, we have to know you just can't jump in and pull something out of context,
right.
Say, "Oh, it says Jesus didn't get an answer, but he did." No, he didn't give an answer to the chief priest. And the answer, that's the answer for our Bible contradiction today.
Bible contradiction.
Sounds like the thinking atheist wasn't thinking on that one.
That was very snarky. Thank you. All right. So back with Dr. Rana Fuzz, we want to know, there is this thing called the C-value enigma. And some people I've been reading, some evolutionary scientists have said, well, even if it's true that the ENCODE project shows that we use all kinds of our DNA, Christians still have to say, why would a designer give these little tiny creatures more DNA than us? I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, and the C-value just simply refers to the amount of DNA that's found in the nucleus of every cell in the body of an organism. And of course, for single-celled organisms, it would only be a single nucleus. And the idea here is that you do see some organisms like amoeba that have more DNA in their nucleus than are found in the nucleuses or the nuclei of cells in the human body. And this is an antiquated idea now that basically says the amount of DNA equates to the complexity of the organism. But there are other ways to think about this, because the DNA may actually be playing a skeletal role, as I mentioned earlier, where some of that DNA may actually be critical for creating a three-dimensional structure to the genome of the organism. And so therefore, it may be that in those single-celled creatures, that the structure of the DNA in three-dimensional space is more critical or more necessary than in cells in the human body.
Interesting.
Also, there's another thing going on, and this is something called the nucleoskeletal hypothesis, which basically says that DNA is also controlling the volume of the nucleus. And so as a cell gets larger, the nucleus has to get larger proportionally. If it doesn't, the organism can't survive. So the volume of the nucleus and the volume of the cell has to be very tightly linked together. And it could be that these single-celled organisms have a much larger cell type than the average cell type of the human body, meaning their nucleus has to be bigger. And it's thought that DNA, the volume of DNA, is actually what dictates the size of the nucleus.
Wow.
So there are explanations for why you see this so-called C-value enigma. And so, again, it's really an antiquated idea that's not taking into account other things that we've learned about the role that DNA plays inside the nucleus. It plays a role that goes beyond just simply being a set of instructions. It also has a skeletal role.
That's fascinating.
That is very interesting.
Thanks for that good answer. Okay, now we're going to challenge you here, push you a little bit. Larry Moran, who's a professor in the Department of Biochemistry at the University of Toronto, he said in response to the ENCODE project that he wasn't really impressed by that 80% number. He said, well, why don't you ask them about the 50% of our genome containing defective transposons, or I'm not really even sure how to pronounce that, and the 2% that's pseudogenes, just for starters. What would you say to that? He seems to be implying to me that there's all sorts of things in our DNA that is junk, even if it had a purpose. It just doesn't work, or it's not useful at all.
Well, again, this goes back to essentially not paying attention or purposely ignoring information that has been published in the scientific literature, because there's a mounting collection of papers that are indicating that things like pseudogenes and transposons are actually playing a functional role. They're not junk DNA, but actually are functional DNA. These are different classes of so-called junk DNA that people identified over the years, and again, just assumed that they were non-functional pieces of DNA. But we've again learned in recent years that what we thought was junk DNA turns out to be functional, and that includes transposons and pseudogenes. And so what's going on here is that 98% of the human genome that consists of transposons and pseudogenes and all these other, again, so-called junk DNA elements is the 80% that has been determined to be functional, that they're playing a role in gene regulation and other things like that. So, again, Larry Moran is talking about ideas that I think are antiquated ideas.
So, basically, he's ignoring what the ENCODE project has come up with, and that is the junk DNA isn't really junk DNA. He's just kind of ignored that.
That's exactly right, because what we've seen over the last 5, 6, 7 years is paper after paper after paper showing that what, again, we thought was junk turns out to be functional. The ENCODE project is just coming along and providing us with a comprehensive quantification of how much of that human genome is actually functional. And so when you put those two sets of results together, you've got a really nice coherent picture that's saying not only does it look as if the human genome is virtually entirely functional, but we understand that what we thought were non-functional sequences have very clearly identified function in separate studies. And so this is a really nice dovetailing together of a number of different experiments looking at the question from different perspectives, and that's extremely gratifying.
That's great. Hey, if you are just joining us, we are speaking with Dr. Fuzzarana from Reasons to Believe, a biochemist, and we've been talking about the ENCODE project. Now, we are coming up. We're in the last 2 minutes, 3 minute, and 2 minute of our show here, and it comes right up on there quick. Uh-huh. Dr. Rana, if you have a couple extra minutes, sometimes we do a little extra for people who come online. Do you have an extra minute or two or three?
Oh, yeah, sure.
All right.
To do that.
So we are going to, if you're listening right now, I'd like you to jump over to truthrevolution.tv, and you're going to get the rest of this interview, because we got to talk about the medical benefits of this ENCODE project. And we also had some listener questions that came in during the week for Dr. Rana. And so I want to thank you all for joining us today at Truth Revolution. And come on out to Revolution Church 10:15 this morning.
Yep. And while you're on our website, you can check out past shows, even do our Truth Shots.
And you can donate. We have Truth Shots Monday through Friday, and you guys make this happen. The people who are willing to give, we just want to say thank you. And yeah, you make the show happen. So come on out to Revolution Church and check out truthrevolution.tv if you want to hear the rest of this interview.
Truth Revolution.
And we're online.
Yes, for you secret knowledge seekers have found the interwebs.
Right. For those of you who actually took the effort to go to our website and actually do make a few clicks and stuff like that,
here's your reward. You get the good stuff.
Hit that feeder bar. We've got it for you.
All right. We're going to pull back the whole brain now of Dr. Rana. I don't know if you knew this, but we made him tie half of it behind his back for that interview. But Dr. Rana, you can use your full brain now. So
thank you very much.
All right. So let's talk about some of the medical benefits. I know that we've said clearly, I mean, this shows that our DNA, it's a good chance it was designed because it seems like it's all useful. And if it was not all useful, it's a good chance it might have just evolved that way. But let's talk about this because this project is so neat. There's actually some real good medical application here. Could you talk about that just for a minute?
Sure thing. Well, because we now have a better understanding of what the different parts of the human genome are doing, when something goes wrong that causes a genetic disorder, let's say, we're now going to be able to go in and identify what part of the human genome has actually changed and what that change is actually doing in biochemical terms. Now, there are these things called genome-wide association studies, where what they do is they take a number of people that have a particular disease, and then they compare their genome to people that don't have that disease. And what they are doing is trying to identify certain sequence fingerprints or sequence patterns that seem to associate with the onset of a particular genetic disorder. Mm-hmm. And when they were doing genome-wide association studies, they were finding these variations that seemed to correspond to a disease, but they had no idea what they meant. Because, again, we didn't know what different parts of the human genome were doing. We haven't cataloged the different functional elements. But now that we have that catalog available, when you find that genome-wide association data, when you have that genome-wide association data, you can simply look up from the ENCODE project what that particular region of the genome is doing. And if you say, this particular region is regulating this particular gene, then you begin to have an understanding as to what's going wrong in that disease.
So
now means that you can design maybe therapies, drugs, or what have you to serve as an intervention.
That makes sense. So essentially, just to break this down in super layman's terms, they have a group of 1,000 people who didn't have this disease. And then they all get the disease, and they look at their genome before and after, and they find out that all of them have little frowny faces on a particular gene now. And they say, that gene must be causing this. Now, can they actually go in there and cause that gene to switch the way it's supposed to, or what do you do with that?
Well, at this point, this is called gene replacement therapy, and at this point, that's a technology that people are hoping they can develop. But right now, there's not been a huge amount of progress made towards that end.
Well, they'd have to change every cell in your body, wouldn't they?
Yes. So it's a really complicated thing to do. And though the idea is simple in principle, trying to carry it out at a clinical setting is really a huge challenge. But one thing that we are recognizing, too, because of the ENCODE project and other work as well, is that sometimes it's not just the genes that have the frowny faces, attached to them. It's other parts of the genome that have the frowny faces. And again, it was really kind of enigmatic because you'd have these frowny faces in regions that people thought were junk. That doesn't make sense. If the DNA is junk, and yet that's where, the damage seems to happen that causes the disease. But now we know those regions really aren't junk, but they actually are playing a functional role. And we know much better what that precise functional role is. which means we now have, again, a way to begin to target, you know, drugs to particular aspects of how the human genome is functioning that very well could lead to new therapies and new treatments, or maybe help to diagnose diseases much earlier, meaning that if people can, receive intervention earlier for a disease, it may not ever progress to a point where, you know, the quality of their life is actually compromised. So those are just two, you know, immediate examples for how the results of the ENCODE project are going to have an immediate impact in terms of, again, understanding disease processes and maybe how to treat those diseases. So in years to come, we're going to benefit tremendously from medical treatments that are directly a result of the work on the ENCODE project.
That is fascinating. I also like how you use the analogy of frowny faces. That was helpful.
That's a great way to describe it. I'm going to have to use that in my talk.
Right. Now, you said different diseases. Is there really any limit? I mean, I know you're not a medical doctor, but as far as you know, could this really help with anything that's an actual disease?
Oh yeah. I mean, for example, there's a lot of diseases that have a genetic component to them. Let's say something like muscular dystrophy as just an example.
Mm-hmm.
When muscular dystrophy hits, you begin to have degeneration of, you know, muscles and nerves, and so this leads to a loss of motor abilities, and ultimately mm-hmm. it leads to what appears to be a very painful, excruciating, you know, end of a person's life. I can't imagine, you know, a more horrible way to suffer and to ultimately die than to experience a loss of motor ability, and ultimately that's going to lead to a loss of, you know, the ability of your systems to even allow you to breathe and do necessary mm-hmm. functions to remain alive. But, you know, most certainly that disease, which is probably has a very complex, you know, set of causes, mm-hmm. is going to have a genetic component. So if we can begin to identify what's exactly going wrong, you know, again, at a genetic level with regard to that disease, it gives us, again, an understanding of that disorder that may lead to better therapy. So things like muscular dystrophy, I think heart disease, you know.
Wow.
The whole gambit. I think a lot of the cancers that people suffer from, this is going to help, I think, help us to identify what's going wrong and leading to that, you know, the onset of cancer in a particular, with regard to a particular type of cancer. So, I mean, the sky's the limit as far as I can see in terms of the usefulness of this data.
No wonder you said that this is one of the most significant discoveries in your time as far as biology goes. It sounds huge.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I would still stand by that statement. This is just an incredible advance because it really is providing us with the Rosetta Stone for how to read the human genome.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's giving us fundamental insight into human biology. And with that fundamental insight, when something goes wrong, we're going to be able to understand fundamentally what went wrong and be able to intervene, hopefully in a way that if it can't correct the problem, at least it can ameliorate the symptoms and improve the quality of life.
Do you know, I mean, are we talking, you know, they'll be able to figure these types of things out 40, 50 years from now? Are we talking, is there any time estimate on these things, or are we not at that point yet?
I think the results of the ENCODE project are being put to use immediately. And so, what you know, almost as soon as the data was published, there were people that are able to go out and suddenly provide a much better interpretation of their genome-wide association studies almost immediately. Mm. So this data is being put to immediate use, and the impact is going to be in short order. It's going to be a few years where we begin to see the positive impacts of this, not, you know, decades.
Well,
that's going to be immediate, provide nearly immediate benefits.
That's awesome.
To biomedical research, and that's going to translate into clinical benefits in very short order.
I suppose that's a good argument for the government running these programs because they just release that information. So that's good.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, governments can spend money in smart ways that really are investments. The way I like to look at it is you can spend the money or you can invest the money. And this, in my mind, is an example of the government investing money and doing it in really a way that is going to have a profound impact on, you know, on human existence,
yeah,
not only for people that live in the United States, but around the world. For years to come.
That's good to know. Because most of the time, government, the way they spend money, it's just kind of, you know.
Down the tubes.
So, sorry, I couldn't help myself. Anyway, okay, so just really briefly, we had two listeners call in, and you can answer these as quickly or as longly as you want. Is longly even a word?
It is now.
It is now.
It's in the Jeff Dictionary.
And so we had a guy named Levi. He wrote in. He said, do you think that the failing of telomeres can be reversed? And if so, what do you think the implications would be on the Christian faith if, by succeeding in telomere reversal, we were able to increase our life expectancy beyond the 120-year limit that God set in Genesis 6? Now, before you answer, Dr. Rana, I'll let you answer the scientific part. I want to answer the biblical part here.
Okay.
And set out that God wasn't setting a 120-year limit on mankind's age. If you look in Genesis 6:3, it says, then the Lord God said, my spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. In that same chapter, Genesis 6, the flood comes and destroys all mankind. So 120 years most likely represents the amount of time from that pronunciation until the flood. It is not a limit on how long people can live. Now, we know it's not a limit because just a little bit after the flood in Genesis 11, people were living way past 120 years.
Mm-hmm.
Selah lived 403. Peleg lived 209. Arphaxad lived 403. So we have that Bible interpretation cleared up. So there's not a big implication for faith here. But Fuzz, what is your take on the telomeres? They are part of the chromosome, and if we can fix these things, could we live indefinitely?
Yeah, well, this is something that's really very interesting, and I'm not sure if we can do anything to repair telomere loss, which definitely will shorten life expectancy, but there are other things that scientists have been working on that seem to have dramatic impacts in terms of life expectancy. So, for example, by increasing the amount of certain enzymes that play a role in preventing oxidative damage from things called free radicals and reactive oxygen species, you can dramatically increase life expectancy in animals that you use in the laboratory. And this is real exciting. And the increase in life expectancy is on the order of about 40 or 50%.
Whoa.
There are other things like resveratrol, which is a compound found in grapes, that actually inhibits an enzyme called a class of enzymes called sirtuins, and it activates them, and when they're activated, that tends to increase life expectancy.
Okay, so eat more grapes or don't eat more grapes?
No. Well, it's hard to get enough of the resveratrol from eating the grapes to actually have an impact.
So I should inject them.
You're gonna have to take the compound like in pure form.
Okay,
you know. So, but the point being that we're beginning to discover these very subtle tweaks to biochemistry that seem to have dramatic impacts in terms of life expectancy. And in fact, there are now scientists who think that if we get a handle on we're getting a handle on what's causing aging, and if we get a handle on that, we might be able to arrest the process or at least slow it down, which means we could very easily have human life expectancy on the order of several hundreds of years. And if that's the case,
wow,
and this is again being discussed in the scientific literature, if that's the case, then those long lifespans in you know, Genesis 5 and Genesis 11 really are not problematic whatsoever. It just very well could be that when human beings were created, that, you know, that they had a biochemistry that allowed for long lifespans, and as a result of the fall, there were changes in that biochemistry that over time accumulated and allowed or prevented human beings from living much longer than, again, the typical life expectancy today.
Huh.
But it could be that we very well could reverse those effects and now have lifespans on the order of several hundred years, if that's the case, then it doesn't look as if the biblical text is being outlandish whatsoever.
Yeah.
But those could literally be true ages.
We're both just sitting here smiling. Like, this information is so great.
Right.
I can't believe I've never actually heard this before. So that's pretty interesting. Now, we have one more question here from Christy. She says, I want to know what the chances are of molecules happening to form, you know, develop DNA, RNA, etc. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that deals with the whole origin of life question. And the fact of the matter is nobody has been able to explain through a process known as chemical evolution or abiogenesis how you could wind up generating life from a collection of chemicals. And so part of that process would involve, you know, RNA and DNA and proteins coming into existence. And it's possible to go into a laboratory and to get chemical reactions to make the building blocks of, let's say, RNA, and to get those RNA building blocks to assemble into the RNA molecule. But as soon as you take those reactions and try to envision how they would work under the conditions of the early Earth, the chemistry is non-productive. The chemistry only works in a laboratory environment at the hands of highly skilled chemists. And so, in effect, what these scientists are demonstrating is that it requires intelligent agency to make life, or to even make the molecules of life. And so, to me, those experiments are really a powerful set of evidences in favor of creation or intelligent design. Because, again, it's an empirical demonstration in the lab that if you want life to come from non-life, or you want molecules that are biologically important to come from, you know, inorganic or you know, non-biologically important molecules, it requires intelligent agents.
That actually reminds me of a joke that is loosely based on the cosmological argument, which says there was a scientist who said, God, you can leave us alone now. We can do everything. We don't even need you. We can even create life from you know, virtually nothing. And God said, really? I'd like to see that. Go ahead. So the scientist took his beaker and reached down and scooped up some dirt. And God said, no. Get your own dirt.
Right.
You know, the point being, everything we have, we're starting with what God's already done. And that's the cosmological argument. But for the point you were making there is the scientists are tweaking these cells, these pieces of information to start life on its tracks, and then saying, see, it can happen by chance, but that's not chance, is it?
Yeah, that to me is you know, the great irony is the very scientists who are doing this work make pronouncements like, if we can make life in the lab, that means it's all that much more reasonable for chemical evolution to happen. And that just is mind-boggling to me because, if anything, they've done the opposite, you know, for the reasons we've just discussed. And so, you know, the irony is lost on these scientists.
Yeah.
But, you know, for somebody who is a believer, you know, these experiments are, I think, a boon to apologetics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you'd never... These same scientists, and I recognize they're talking about evolution on a scale of billions of years, but these same scientists would never go into a bicycle shop, see someone building a bicycle, and then say, huh, I should go look in a forest to see if one of these arose by chance. You know, I mean, just because someone can create something by design doesn't mean it can happen by chance. I mean, the odds of that are still so low. So, all right, well, hey, thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Rana.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been a great time, and we hope to have you back sometime. And, you know, for everybody who is listening on with us today, you can get more information about Dr. Rana and his ministry if you go to reasons.org. That's reasons.org. And you can check out his books, The Cell's Design, The Origins of Life, and Who Was Adam? Now, your most recent one was The Cell's Design. Is that correct?
Actually, it's Creating Life in the Lab.
Oh, there's a new one that I wasn't even aware of. Creating Life in the Lab. Okay. That's great. And what is that one about?
About what we just discussed, about the attempts of scientists to go into the lab and to create artificial life forms, artificial cells. And, you know, the question is, you know, that the book addresses is what happens when scientists are able to do that in terms of the argument for design.
Awesome. So if any of you are more interested in this, you should go out and get that book, Creating Life in the Lab. I think I'm going to go do that.
Right. Reasons.org is that website.
And you're already at truthrevolution.tv. And we'd like to thank you for listening with us today. Consider donating because you are the ones who make this show happen. Have a great day and God bless.